Hello and welcome to Stranger Than Fiction, a series of podcasts from Slate and the New America Foundation about the future as seen through the eyes of some of today's best speculative and science fiction authors. I'm your host, Tim Wu, and my guest today is Margaret Atwood, who is the author of the internationally best-selling novel The Handmaid's Tale, as well as the 2000 Booker Prize winner The Blind Assassin, and more than 40 other books. Her most recent works, After the Flood and I'm Starved for You, are set in what she calls a possible future. Margaret, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about your latest work, I'm Starved for You. The story, which I loved, it's hilariously funny story, is disturbing, but funny. It takes place in a very strange future where, after decades of economic decline, entire towns have become prisons. And the residents spend half their time as prisoners and the rest of the time working at the prison. And I just wanted
to... It's full employment.
Yeah, full employment theory, because when you're not a prisoner, you're out working at the prison. I just wanted to ask you what possibly gave you this idea for the story.
Well, I think probably all my background in reading and writing about prisons over the years. For instance, Alias Grace is set in Kingston Penitentiary in the middle of the 19th century. And people were theorizing full out about prisons in the 19th century because what preceded something like the Kingston Penitentiary, which was viewed as very progressive in its day, what preceded that was something like Newgate in England, in which everybody was thrown in together. You could be put in prison for debt. You could not pay off the debt because you couldn't have a job. You were sort of stuck. So people were thinking a lot about prison reform, and there were various different models that evolved over that century. So what are prisons for? Are they to punish people? Are they to get them out of the way so that they don't harm other people? Are they to reform them? That's where our word reformatory came from. Are they to make them penitent so they will become a better person? That's where penitentiary came from. And penitentiaries taught them to read and write so they could read the Bible and become better people. And we've kind of forgotten those roots. Then there's the Australian model, in which convicts were sent to Australia essentially to develop it as a colony. And one of the interesting things that happened with that was that they sent all these male convicts out and then realized that there was a big shortage of women. But they didn't have enough women of the right level of criminality to be transported. So they lowered the bar. So you got That's transported right. as a man for, you know, serial killing or whatever they did, not quite, breaking and entering and what have you. And for a woman, you got transported for coughing.
Right. So
all these women suddenly found themselves on a ship to Australia being branded as whores and no goods. And they were dumped off at the other end and essentially had to marry up with the convicts that were there because they had such a calming influence.
Right.
So that's the distant model of what I'm doing, which is, okay, what are prisons for? Are they to create jobs? Because that's how they're being used in some states in the United States right now. You can look at the Louisiana prison system. It's a job creator. So let's take that to the fullest extent and say, well, let's be honest about this. If it's for job creation, how can we best do this? We can best do it by giving everybody turn and turn about a turn at being a prisoner and then a turn at being a guard or other provider in the town that surrounds the prison and then putting a big wall around the whole thing and getting rid of the actual criminals because they do cause such a problem.
Well, that's one of the funny parts about the story is where this two themes of or the two theories of why to have a prison run into each other. When the new prisoners run into the people who are already in the prison, presumably because they're dangerous and they want to keep them away from other people.
It's a problem.
And then they start fighting in the cafeteria. And the guards aren't really guards, so they don't know how to deal with it.
They don't know how to deal with it now. So what is the obvious solution to that? Well, some people just don't fit here anymore.
Yeah. So the employment...
Don't fit in this prison.
The theory of a prison as an employment center has to take over from the idea of incarceration. And so... Or
the idea of keep dangerous people away from everybody else.
Right, which in criminal law is known as a specific deterrence is the term of art.
Yes, well, since people are lining up to get into the system now because you could have a nice house, which you, of course, share with your alternates when you're in the prison. Yeah. So you turn and turn about with the house. which cuts down on, you know, the cost of housing.
Yeah, that's what they pointed out. Like, you have to, you can't
only
leave
there half the, you're only there half the time. Yeah. You are expected to leave it clean.
Yeah.
But the other upside is that when you're a prisoner and eating the prison food, next month you will be providing the prison food. So the food is actually pretty good.
Well, I hope I'm not giving too much away, but when they get rid of the prisoners in your story, the trade-off is that the prisoners are killed, but they get a lot of pleasure in the killing. They enjoy a few minutes of absolute...
We're not monsters.
Right, right. So even though they do need the prison for employment as opposed to actual prisoners, nonetheless, yes, the trade-off is that the prisoners get to have a bit of
a moment
fun.
Of bliss.
Yeah,
yeah, about 5 minutes.
As they go on.
Which is probably more than you'd have if you were being executed.
No, I've often wondered why they don't make execution more pleasurable.
Fun. But, well, maybe they're afraid there would be a long list of people who would want to do it.
Wow. One of the things that fascinated me about this book, it's not quite a book, I guess, story, is that it made the prison community out to be a beacon of hope in a desperate time. And I'm going to quote from your work. It said, "They've chosen to risk themselves to take a gamble on the brighter side of human nature. They were like the early pioneers, clearing a way to the future, a future that would be more secure, more prosperous, and just all around better." So sort of a sense of positive thinking.
How do any of these things start?
Yeah.
They always start as utopias. And, of course, in order to sell this whole deal to people outside the first model community, which is called consilience, in order to sell the idea to people outside, you're going to have to say something like that, aren't you?
Yeah, I guess it stands to reason. But
so providing jobs for the jobless, creating a stable community, full employment, nice housing, good food. There are a couple of drawbacks. You can't get out.
Yeah, life sentence.
But once in, there you are.
That's
now,
true.
The big question, which I'm now proceeding to answer in the sequels I'm writing, numbers 2 and 3, how is this thing making money?
Mm. So, you know, you were just talking about how every project has to start as utopian. And one of the things, if you read science fiction or other works about the future, there's a very strong tendency for such works to be either utopian or dystopian. And do you think that's something the writers of the future have to make a choice about, or is it just something that kind of naturally happens?
I think it kind of naturally happens, but there were so many utopias in the 19th century because it was a utopian century. Mm-hmm. It really did believe that things were going to get better and better and better and better and better, mm-hmm, because enough things had gotten better and better. So there were so many utopias produced then that people started writing satires about them, which is why there's a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta called Utopia Limited. But then along came the First World War, though there had been a negative trend even before that. But after the First World War, it became almost impossible to write a utopian vision with the same degree of hope and optimism, unless you set it on another planet.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I'm sure you know Barbara Ehrenreich, the writer.
Yeah.
She's written a book recently about America and positive thinking.
I've seen her wonderful YouTube about that, and she's right. I mean, if you're in the full spate of positivity, then every negative thing that happens to you in your life is your own fault because you've had the wrong attitude.
Exactly.
So you get cancer, you get run over by a truck, you must have been attracting negative vibes by your bad attitude. It's not anybody else's fault.
Well, I was wondering whether if you think there's a difference between the sort of utopianism and excitement about the future of the Victorian era and our own present-day mandated positive thinking. Are they kind of the same thing, or is there...
No, they're quite different, because the mandated positive thinking applies to individuals.
Right.
It never applies, for instance, to America the country. If you say about America the country, well, this bad thing happened to you because you had a bad attitude, that will not go over at all. not Dixie Chicks. Need I just say that?
Right.
The utopian thinking that was going on in the 19th century was a matter of structure. People wanting to rearrange the blueprint to do things really so much better. And there were a lot of those written, and there was a trickle of them in the 20th century, but by and large it was dystopias. And with the dystopia as a form, things are much worse than what we have, and what we have is seen as the greater good. You know,
right.
So what your job is, you must preserve, imperfect though it is, you must preserve what we have now rather than fall into the horrible society that would be the result of changing anything too radically.
You know, Huxley wrote a book I'm fascinated with as well, Island. I don't know if you've heard of it or read it. Most people
haven't. Yeah, later, yeah.
Yeah, which was actually a utopian book about all the ways he thought things actually could be better. In some ways, similar to your Craik's vision of improved humanity, in the sense that he focuses on misplaced male aggression and sexual repression as the main source of all problems.
Yeah,
and
good luck with that.
Yeah. I notice in Oinks and Craik, I might be saying
Oryx,
that right.
Yeah.
Oryx and Craik, the solution is to have women turn blue when it's time to have sex.
And men signal.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so essentially it's a mammalian solution because most mammals, in fact, are not sexually available all the time. They have seasons during which they mate, and the rest of the time they don't. So if you had that arrangement, such as, for instance, baboons, not only would you have all this mating stuff limited in time, but there would be clear signals. So there would never be any, I'm sorry, I can't, I'm washing my hair this Friday. There would be no rejection. There would be no heartbreak. There would be no romance. There would be no feelings of inadequacy and inferiority. Everybody would participate in the mating season, and that would be that. And there would be no misplaced signals. So if you're blue, you're blue, and it's very clear.
Action.
To get rid of a lot of the problems that we have among us today.
Right.
For instance, they don't need clothes because they are engineered to be able to resist the climate. And one of the good features, which I like a lot, they've got built-in insect repellent.
Yeah, that would help.
I think we should aim for that.
In that projection of the future, there's a lot of improvements, like you say, the insect repellent skin and so forth. But it was kind of unclear to me whether you actually thought these were improvements or whether it was just sort of put out there as an interesting idea. I wonder, maybe... You were just sort of doing it for fun. But I wonder if you ever seriously thought maybe it would be better if there weren't all these broken hearts.
Think of it from the point of view of their creator. And what we always go back to with any of these things that people are working on right now is the planet is a certain size. You
right.
can't make it bigger.
Right.
And it's running out of stuff. So how are you going to respond to the burgeoning human population and the inability to make the planet bigger? And one of the ways that we're responding right now is thinking about ways of growing more food for ourselves in different ways, such as vertical gardens and lab meat. So how do you make better use of the space you have? But another solution would be to get rid of humanity as a failed experiment and replace it with something that's better designed to make non-aggressive use of space.
Well, maybe it was just my, certain species pride or something like that, but I couldn't help feeling that it just seemed kind of boring. I mean,
it's boring to you.
I know. Their big excitement of the day is...
The life of a snail is boring to you, but it's pretty exciting for the snail.
Yeah, I guess so.
I have a pro-human bias, but I'm old-fashioned.
Yeah. You know, obviously, as you said, you write fiction of the future as a projection as to what could happen. And I wonder if you think things have gone in different directions than you expected.
Well, they're going in the direction that they were beginning to go then. Hmm. And all of these kinds of things are answers to theoretical questions, and the Handmaid's Tale is an answer to the question, if you were going to create a dictatorship in America, how would you do it? What rationale would you provide? What flag would you fly? How would people be made to believe that what they were getting would be better than what they had? Mm-hmm. Because that's how dictatorships come in. They come in because people are scared and they want somebody to take charge and they think that the alternative is anarchy, chaos. So how would you present it in America? Well, you wouldn't say, hello, let's all be communists. That's not going to work. I thought at the time that you wouldn't say, well, we're a liberal democracy, but we have to preserve our liberal democracy by becoming more like a dictatorship. I would have thought that that was an oxymoron, but I'm not so sure anymore because people are trying that on. The real answer is, say you're doing it in the name of religion, and you might be able to get the 30% necessary to implement such a change, especially if you combine that with a coup.
Well, little did you know that what you really have to threaten is Canadian-style health care. That would be the galvanizing force that will make Americans rise up. And
if they want to die in squalor, that's really up to them.
Let me turn to something else. One of the ideas you've expressed sometimes and kind of comes through in your books is the idea that whether it's 1,000 years ago or in the future somewhere, that certain aspects of human nature don't really seem to change. You know, you can get this sense from reading mythology or whatever you want. And I wonder if that's true, does it sort of leave us hopeless? Or
no, we're also very malleable.
Right.
So let's say we come with a basic template and some of those switches can be turned on or they can be turned off.
Right.
And that's what epigeneticists are studying now. So what comes built in at what age of development did those switches get turned on by a culture? And if they're not turned on, how hard is it to turn them on later? For instance, if you don't learn to talk before the age of 8, how hard is it to learn to talk after that? The ability to understand and tell stories, the ability to make visual objects and images. And what else would you say? Oh, the fairness thing. That's not fair. His is bigger than mine.
Right.
I want 2 cookies, too.
Right.
So all of that kicks in before the age of 4.
So you don't, for example, think that sort of patterns of aggression and killing, which seem to be the hallmark of our species, you don't think that's hardwired in, or you do, or you think it's...
I think pushing and shoving is.
Right.
Because kids do it, but they don't kill each other. They do like to see villains punished in fairy tales. They like it when our hero gets the princess or our princess gets the hero and the bad people are foiled. They do like that part. They certainly experience jealousy pretty early on. And so do dogs. it's a very fundamental thing. So telling people not to be jealous, that's not going to particularly work. You might tell them about ways to acknowledge their jealousy and then deal with it, but just telling them not to do it isn't going to work. Just as telling kids that there is nothing under the bed, don't be silly, if they're 2 or 3, is not going to work either. You have to instead say, well, there is, but I've made a deal with them, and they're not coming out tonight.
So in your book, Oryx and Crake, there's this deliberate effort to try to genetically engineer religion out of humanity, but it doesn't completely seem to succeed, which might suggest that maybe you think religion is fundamental as well, hardwired at a very deep level.
I think it comes with the narrative capability,
mm-hmm.
so that once you have a grammar-based narrative, which has a past tense and a future tense, you're going to have what happened before that, and what about that, and what about before that. And you're also going to have what will happen after that, and after that, and after that. So I think that part comes with. I think there are a couple of cultures that we know about that don't have an elaborate grammar like that, and also don't seem to be very interested in religion.
Wow.
But the other thing that a religion will give you is, by the way, there's this powerful being who is on our side, except that you can't see them.
Right.
However, I, the shamanistic person, will go into a trance and go and intercede with them for you. And let me add to that that if you're badly behaved, they're going to stop giving you whales, seals, and walruses to eat. So there's that part of it. I think narrative was probably a really good survival tool when there were small groups of people with a lot of things out there that were threatening to them. So if you could tell a story about either how to do a better act of hunting or how to avoid a dangerous predator, if you could tell that to the younger members of your group, they were going to be better prepared.
Well, Margaret, it's been a great pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
And a great pleasure talking with you.
I've been talking with author Margaret Atwood. I'd like to thank our producer, Toy Bosch, our engineer, Chris Wade, and Andrew Martinez of the New America Foundation. The executive producer of Slate's podcast is Andy Bowers. I'm Tim Wu, and thank you for listening.